It's been amazing today for me. I've learned loads from you. The things you've, perceptive things that you've picked up on, have gone, oh yeah, I didn't actually know why I do certain things because I haven't broken it down. But you have broken it down. It's really, really, you've inspired me. And you've got a very analytical brain and you're asking the right questions.
Hello and welcome back to the Journey Onwards podcast. And if you're here for the first time, then I welcome you to the tribe. I hope you've had a good week so far. I'm your host, Anand Datani, and boy, do I have a roller coaster of a story for you today. I recently connected with today's guest after he heard me speak about the purpose of the podcast and the community I'm creating. My goal is to help people explore how their family backstory and the culture they grew up in have shaped their values, what they see as their purpose, as well as their perspective on some of life's commonly asked questions, and ultimately what you can learn from each of their experiences and lessons. And the story of Kojo is one of those that made me sit back and think, this is someone who really has lived through a number of life-changing and life-defining moments. And by life-defining, I'm referring to those that brought about an added meaning or purpose to life, which in some cases, especially for Kojo, this comes from a radical and unexpected shift in what you believed to be a mapped out trajectory of your life. So I'll keep this brief because Kojo goes into his personal account of it during the conversation, but he was born to a Scottish mother and Ghanaian father, and he spent the early years being raised by his mother and grandmother, who had moved to the Highlands of Scotland from Brazil when his mother was only six. In part one, Kojo speaks of growing up as the only coloured person in a white-dominated area, and he tells a great story of how it was to attend his first Ghanaian party with his dad's side of the family. We also cover how being looked at for being different to the other kids acted as fuel of motivation for him to, as he describes it, give them a real reason to want to stare at him. There's so much more to the story and some great perspectives that he shares. I'm sure you're going to love it. So I thank you for listening. And thank you, Kojo, for joining me on the Journey Onwards podcast.
Morning. How are you doing?
Very, very good. I'm excited for this. And the reason why is, so I know you'll be identified by many as, you know, lifestyle, business and well-being coach. But I feel that this only really scratches the surface of how much depth there is to your backstory, both personally and professionally. So, you know, in your, say, 30-year career, I know you've worked with some really well-known personalities and brands and even TV shows that I'm sure a lot of the listeners will recognize and probably even have watched. So I'm excited to hear about how your life journey really took you through those stages and successes and brought you to what you're striving for now, which, as you describe, is to become the Steve Jobs of health, fitness and well-being, right? So before we get into that, what I'd love to do is go back even before this, because I know that your mother and her parents' story is really fascinating, and it also played a huge role in you becoming the person you are today. So I'd love you to start by giving an insight into what their journey was.
Perfect. So I don't sound, look, I've got a name that is Scottish because I'm Kojo Ajay. Got a Cockney accent, born and bred actually in Brighton, which is a very similar accent to London. Lived all my adult life in London. But I'm actually Scottish. My granddad's name is Hector MacDonald, and he's born and bred in the Highlands of Scotland. And my mum's called Sheila Ann MacDonald. And many, many years ago, my granddad went from the Highlands of Scotland to Brazil, and then he met my grandma, Inez Elena Barrett. My grandma was born in Crouch End in London. She moved to Brazil when she was really, really young. So she meets my granddad out there. They get married, have my mum and my uncle. So my mum was born in Rio de Janeiro in 42 or something. You know what? I should know when my mum was born. I think it might be 39. It's 39 or 42, and it's around the war bit. And then when the war ended, then my mum, I think she was six, they all got a boat and came over to the Highlands, and then they had a farm in the Highlands of Scotland, which is where I live now. I live in a place called Cromarty.
Right.
Interestingly enough, my mum was talking to the neighbours, like they live about three doors away, and I mentor their grand children. I mentor one of the boys whose his mum had split up with her partner, and so he didn't have a male role model. So she came to me in the summer, just when we came out of lockdown for a bit, and said, my son needs a male role model and I wonder if you could coach and mentor him. So I started coaching and mentoring him. And then her sister's son, who's best friends with this kiddie, he started getting in a bit of trouble at school. So they said, would I mentor and coach him? And I go rowing with the grandparents, and I'm friends with these two, with the two mums. And now my business partner in America is married to their other sister. He lives in San Francisco, so there's four sisters, but they're all from this little place in the Highlands. And my mum and the grandfather had been speaking, and you know, they knew that their farms were next to each other. And in a conversation about 2 days ago, they were talking, and my mum said that she was related to this, I think it's Alistair Matheson, and Ewan Garrett said, so am I related to Alistair Matheson. So it turns out that I'm actually related to the kids that I've been mentoring, and we've just found out on Friday, wow. So literally 2 days ago. So then I'm phoning San Francisco. I'm in a business call with this guy called Naftali, does all my branding and design. And I'm going, yo, bro. I said, get your wife on the phone. And she comes on. I goes, Jojo, I'm your cuz. We're related. And she goes, what are you talking about? And then I got the granddad to come and he explained that story I've just told you. So yeah, it's mad. In the Highlands, there's small communities and everyone's related to everyone, as I just found out. So anyway, yeah, they've gone to come over here, done the farm. And then my granddad unfortunately died of cancer. And my grandma was ill in hospital at the time as well. So they thought she was going to die, and it ended up my granddad died and she was too ill to run the farm. So they all moved down to a place called Limfield in Sussex. And to give you an idea of the area I live, I was born on April the 5th, 1965. And I think Piers Morgan was born 6 days before me in the same hospital. So he's from the same area. I've known him all my life, like playing cricket and things like that against him.
So that sort of famous celebrity connection was always in your blood ever since birth.
Yeah, but also that, you know, is a very white, upper class, middle class, conservative stronghold. If you think of Piers Morgan, that's the sort of people I was brought up with. That's surrounded no people of colour.
Right.
So that's where my mum was brought up. She went to school down there. And then when she was about, must have been 20, 21, yeah, she met my father, who was over from Ghana, and he was speaking at a United Nations, there was a United Nations sort of club where they do discussions and things like that, and then they play music. So my mum first met my dad by hearing him speak. And then when she heard him speak, you know, danced a bit, and then, yeah. Along comes me. So there's the Ghanaian roots, the Brazilian roots, the Scottish roots. But yeah, traveling is in the white side of my family, definitely. They had this adventurous streak. And my mum traveled a lot when she was young. She went, before she had me, and she had me at 21, she'd lived in Barcelona and lived in Canada, where she'd worked at a hotel of my uncle's in Canada. So traveling is definitely in the genes on that side. And my dad's a bit of a boy and had 9 children by 9 different women.
Oh, wow.
I've still got 3 sisters to meet that I met. They're in Ghana at the moment, and I've never been to Ghana. And we're in the middle of selling houses there. So when I go over to Ghana, I was trying to go in February, but because of lockdown, I couldn't go. So I'm going to meet 3 sisters there. And I met 2 sisters for the first time at his funeral. And my brother, I've only got 1 brother, I never knew about him. And when I was 13, I was at school, and there was no other black families or anything in the area. And then a teacher, it's physics, comes along, new teacher, and he goes, Ajay. And I goes, yes, sir. He goes, have you got a brother? I said, no, sir. And he goes, well, I've just come from Shoreham School for Boys, which is about 20 miles away. Right. And he goes, there's someone with the same surname as you who looks like you. So I go home and I'm like, Mom, Mr. Bamford said. She goes, Stephen, because Stephen's like my English name. Kojo is my Ghanaian name. The day I was born, Monday, Kojo. She goes, Stephen, sit down. Something I've got to tell you.
Wow.
And she goes, yeah, you've got a brother. And it turns out that he was born in November and I was born in April of the same year. My mum found, my dad was out. He used to go up to London for the weekend, hang out with his uncle, cousins and all that sort of thing. My mum finds a piece of paper in doing the washing in my dad's my dad's jeans or trousers, phones it up, and the woman goes, I'm Mrs. Ajay. And my mum's like, no, I'm Mrs. Ajay. And
it's, oh my God.
There's two screaming babies in the background. So they go, I've heard this story by my mum and my dad. So then they go to, they go and meet each other. And then my mum makes, they've both got screaming babies. My mum makes her drive up to Brixton where my dad was at my uncle Peter's, knocks on the door and they go in. And my mum said to compound things, she finds my dad with like two young Ghanaian girls on each leg being a bit of a boy.
Wow.
And yeah, I think she said, I'm not proud of myself, but she slapped him. And then she used my brother's birth certificate in the divorce. And then I didn't meet my brother until I went off playing dancing, came back, played football. And I kept seeing him in the papers, Ajay this and Ajay that. And I was in the papers as well for football. And then eventually I signed for the same team as him because I just wanted to get to know him. And then the manager introduced me to him in the change room at half time of a game and went, Roy, this is Steve. Steve, this is Roy. And then Roy went to me, you might have all the dancing talent in the family, but I'm the good looking one. And that's how we met. And we played football together for 4 years. And that was possibly some of the best times of my life, really connecting with my brother, playing football and going out drinking after the game. So yeah, that's a little bit about amazing. My background.
that's awesome. One thing that you touched on was how so your grandparents, they separately, they were both born in the UK and then they both separately went to Brazil and that's where they met.
Yeah.
Do you know why they moved there? Was it something?
My grandma, I think they just, her parents decided to go out there and she, all I know is that I've just seen from my mum's got bits and pieces and I've seen that she there was lots of things saying she was a really good horsewoman. I'm not sure the reasons why, but I know she was really active and quite tomboyish. And I'm presuming, I've never actually asked this question, but I'm presuming because my granddad used to work for Shell, I'm presuming it was to do with oil, because up in the Highlands, in the Firth, which is another name for sea or like lake, it's the Cromarty Firth where I'm here is the deepest natural sort of port in Europe. And there's loads of oil rigs and they build our oil rigs and they repair them in the Firth just outside my window. You can see oil rigs now. So I'm thinking there was a connection possibly with oil and got loads of people to go out there and work. But I will have to ask my mum that question because I don't actually know.
Yes, that's fascinating. I didn't know that kind of transport routes were even open or considered back then, which is fascinating.
So if you Google Cromarty, it's been a port, a merchant port for centuries, and it had royal status, and it's been the architecture in Cromarty. They say it's the finest architecture in the Highlands because it's got old fishing cottages, a bit like St. Ives in Cornwall and all that sort of thing. So you've got that. And then you've got big merchant houses because they were really, really wealthy. And, you know, I'm pretty sure, in fact, I know that there was some of the slave trade thing did hit here.
Yeah, it's amazing because I remember seeing on your Instagram recently where you posted that you normally walk, I think it's the 100 steps up the north side.
I usually go up the south side.
South side. There was that day you went up the north side and... Yeah, the background just looked incredible. It looked amazing.
Yeah, no, the scenery up here, like I've traveled a lot around the world and I'd say I've got a seat that this 100 steps, and the 100 steps is not 100 steps right next to each other. It's like you do 10 steps and then you might walk 100 meters and then you've got 5 steps, you know, it's not, but when you get up the top or about 3/4, there's a bench. That's my favorite place to sit in the whole world. I used to have two Hungarian Vizslas. One died about a year ago, the week before his 13th birthday, and his ashes are spread behind this bench. I'll go and sit there with my other dog every day, and I swear, when it's, I say that that's the most beautiful spot in the world, when I sit on there, and you can see dolphins as well. We get dolphins in here, so if you go at the right time, when the currents are right, you see dolphins there. On a sunny day, I'd say the Highlands is one of the most beautiful places in the world, and Cromarty in spots is like that. Trouble is, it's not sunny that often in the Highlands of Scotland. Ever since I've come here, I've done that walk near enough every single day. I do it, and come rain or sunshine or snow, and it looks great in all the different seasons. And I actually want one day, I want to take a photo from the same spot every day for a whole year to show the different things. Sometimes I've been in bad places in my head, and I've come up from London to get away, and I've gone on that walk. Yeah. By the time I've sat down and come on the way back, all my troubles have gone away.
That's amazing. So
it's a magical spot.
And you were touching on the really nice memories of you and your brother. I'd love to hear more about what your upbringing in childhood life was like, and even the home environment. How was that?
So in the home environment, I was brought up by, my dad wasn't about. I can remember he came and visited me when I was about four.
Yeah.
And he came with some uncles, and they were jet black. And you've got to understand, I haven't been around black people. So he could, like, really, really dark. And they all had dark suits on and dark sunglasses. And they came and got me from my house and put me in the car to take me up to London. And I shat myself. I was like, I was scared. I was scared of, you know, these guys were really, really black, and they had African accents, and they were talking in Twi, which is Ghanaian language, sort of, and broken English, and laughing loudly and all this and everything. And I was just sat in the back, petrified. And so I just remember that fear.
Yeah.
But then when I got to London, I think we went to a party in Battersea, and I'd never been to a Ghanaian party before. And even though I was 4 or 5 or whatever age I was, it was amazing, and there was just so many kids there, and it was like the party went on the whole weekend, and we just stayed. There was loads of food, and there was loads of drink, and loud and noisy, and I just loved it. And then I was being brought up in this very English, you know, my grandma and her friends would come around for tea, Mrs. Bainton, and they'd have the fine china out, and we'd have tea and scones with jam and cucumber sandwiches.
Yeah.
So I had... That was most of my life was like that.
I love that you've touched on that, because one thing that I really am fascinated by understanding is how people of these kind of backstories navigate those identities. And I think yours, as you've described it, they're quite different. At least, you know, some people, they'll have these two identities of the place they grew up versus maybe the place their parents grew up. Yours, even from both of your parents, even compared to you, they have very contrasting life. So how did you navigate between your identity growing up of who you were and where you fit in?
It was like I never fitted in,
right?
Because I and even to this day, like, I had this conversation with the mum that I was talking about, that I look after her son, and I'm in their bubble, and she said, you must feel like you don't fit in anywhere, you know, because I'm living in Scotland, black guy, Cockney accent in Scotland. Mm. I'm like, yeah, definitely don't fit in here. And then when I was growing up, I was this, you know, sticking out like a sore thumb. And I was brought, you know, both my mum and my grandma are white, very well spoken. I don't know what happened to me. I think I rebelled against it. And I just knew, you know, I knew it was different. And then growing up, all my football heroes and cricket, like, my heroes was Pele. I had a picture of him on the ceiling. I just had Pele everywhere. Viv Richards at cricket, Muhammad Ali at boxing, and Daley Thompson. So I identified with people of colour. That's my heroes. And then my best friends were the Price boys. There was 3 of them. And their dad, Pat Price, taught me how to play football and cricket. And we all played for Sussex at cricket. We were all good at football, and we just played sport, and everyone called me the 4th Price brother.
Did
the whole pinprick thing and became blood brothers once, and we still call us, I'm still the 4th Price brother. And they never saw me as any, you know, when I was with them, we were brothers.
Yeah.
There was no colour didn't come into it. And all the kids in our little circle, they've all said now, they're like, when they hear some of the things that, you know, when the Black Lives Matter things came out and spoke about things, they just didn't realise. They were like, you're Adj.
Yeah.
I just, everyone was nice to me, but then there was like people always doing this, and do you get sun, you know, can you get sunburnt? Do you go darker in the sun? I had an afro hair, so they're bouncing things off it. And sometimes, you know, people would be staring at you and little kids touching you, thinking you're not real and things like that. So there was that almost feeling like an alien. And there was a part of me that felt like everyone stares at me all the time. So I used, part of me was like, you know what? I'm going to give you something to stare at. So I'd be like, it made me dress more flamboyantly. It made me, yeah, I wasn't worried about standing out. I was like, no, I want to stand out. And I say, that's what made me, I knew I wasn't the same as everyone else. And I knew I wasn't ordinary. So I was like, I'm going to be extraordinary.
That's amazing.
That's and I've gone through life that I want to be the best at everything. I had to always be the best. I wanted to be the best footballer, best dancer, best runner. If you think about it, when I say my goal is to be Steve Jobs of health, fitness and lifestyle, is to be, you know, someone, like for me, Muhammad Ali is the best boxer, at the greatest of all time. Pele, now you can argue Cristiano Ronaldo, yeah. Messi, Lionel Messi, Diego Maradona, but Pele is going to be in there. And my time.
Always remembered, yeah.
You know, when I was growing up, there was no doubt that Pele was the greatest footballer in the world. And at the time, Viv Richards was the greatest cricket batsman. And Daley Thompson was unbeaten for 9 years, and you know, world records, 2 gold medals, 4 world champions. You know, he was unbeaten for 9 years. He was the greatest athlete because he was decathlete. So there was a bit in this me that I want to be the greatest of all time at whatever I do, which is good because it drives you. But there's a part of it, how many people can be the greatest whatever in the world? About everyone else thinks I'm successful and I've achieved a lot. Whereas for me, I haven't. It's like, I'm not done what I want to do.
And you hear that a lot. I think you've touched on it and you know it very well about what often holds people back is that, I guess you can call it perfectionist mindset, but the idea of you set this expectation for yourself to be the best at it. But do you think this standing out, do you think that really fueled you in a way that were you trying to prove to others that if you're going to look at me, I'm going to make it worth your while to be looking at me and be like, if I was looking at him in more of an inferior way, I was wrong to do so. Well, I guess I'm what trying to say is, were you almost doing it to prove them wrong?
Yeah, I think there's part of that proving wrong. And as I said, everyone's staring. So it's like, okay, I'm gonna make you stare at me by what I'm wearing and what I'm doing, as opposed to you're staring at me for, cause I'm black. You're gonna stare at me because I'm special.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when I went into dance, my teacher was a guy called Charles Organs, who's like a mentor, and he used to, there was a lot of black guys in the class, and then every now and then there'd be a white kid who was really good. And he'd get us all together, all the black boys, and go, how can you let that white boy dance better than you? And he said, you know, to get the job, you've got to be 10 times better than him to get any job. And he drilled it into us, so you've got to be 10 times than a white guy to get a job. So in my career at dancing, I was like, to get the job. Let's say if there was a job and they needed 10 people, the chances are they'd have 9 white guys on 1 black guy. So then you're fighting the numbers of what you're fighting for that one role. It's even harder. If you look at, you know, X Factor and all that Britain's Got Talent stuff, that audition type feel, that's what it's like. Mm. When you're a professional dancer, that's what it's like to get every decent job. So I just made sure that if there was 1 black guy, it's going to be me.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'd be quite interested to know, did you feel that in these environments, to some degree, before you've even performed, that a lot of the judges or whatever they may be already have part of their mind made up of whether they want you or not before they've even, you know, watched you perform?
100%.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about that. And so I suppose you had to be physically, when you get into this, I'm talking about commercial dancing, and ballet is a whole different ball game. But which I did that, which is really hard to get into if you're a person of colour. But in the commercial world, what you look like, that's got a part of you getting the job before you've even danced a step. So I made sure I was, you know, I was known. In the whole business, there was probably one other guy whose body was as good as mine, a guy called Paul Swaby. His top half, his body, it was like he was chiseled. People, when we used to do shows like modelling or dancing shows, you have to have your top off. No one wanted to go walk next to him. And the only person that would walk next to him was me. He was taller than me, but his legs, he had skinny legs. And because I come from football, got big thighs, big calf muscles. So I used to walk with him. So that's why I'm competitive. You know, you can tell there's a competitive part of me. So yeah, between me and him were the two best bodies in the commercial dancing world at that point.
Yeah, that's amazing. Do you think that firstly, you know, that drive to, I'm going to prove that I'm special and really have that determination to make that happen, plus the competitive edge that you have, I guess, from your upbringing and all the sports that you've played, do you think that really helped as a catalyst to push you to that next step in your career, you know, where you started working with some of these well-known names and brands?
Yeah, 100%. And I think from the transition from being a dancer and then modelling, and when I was modelling, you've got straight models that do catwalks and photographic stuff. And I was with an agency to do that. There was one particular company called Production Team that I worked with for years that they used models and then they used dancers that looked like models. And there's a very, in that category of models that can dance and dancers that look like models. Because the guys, you've got to be around the 6 foot mark, and the girls, you've got to be over 5'9", 5'10". So there's very few dancers that are that tall and look that way. And the same way with models, there's very few models that can actually dance. So when you're in that very small niche thing that can do that, you got work. So, and that's how I started first working for the sportswear brands, which I loved, because then the global brands, when they do marketing campaigns and they have global conferences and launches of kits or launches of football boots or launches of football, you're always getting those jobs. And then, so working with the Adidases, the Nikes, the Umbros, the Pumas, that was good. And then when I transformed into becoming a choreographer, that was my niche at choreographing, was doing sports and dance mixed together, because that was my background. That's my love and passion, the combination of the two. So working for those sportswear brands, where then the competition thing, and especially between Adidas and Nike. So when I remember Adidas, and this is where you go to the mindset, when there's an impossible is nothing campaign, and which uses Muhammad Ali, as I said before, is my big hero, greatest hero of all time. And I got to work with him and meet him in Orlando.
Wow.
And it was the impossible is nothing. And so, and they were showing, it's an old advert where it's him in, it's Ali, Bumbaye, it's like for the Rumble in the Jungle. And he's running through these streets and it's old footage.
Yeah.
And the Adidas, Edward Schultz is the CEO of Adidas. It's the last day of a 4-day Adidas conference. And he's going, and they're showing the advert on the back on the big screens to launch the campaign. Well, just before that, he goes, Muhammad Ali's backstage and I've got to put him on stage and, you know, just say what he's got to do. And I'm there with my girlfriend at the time. And Muhammad Ali's there and he's in the sort of wheelchair because he's got Parkinson's. And then we ask him, can we have a picture? And he goes, yeah. And then you have to ask his help. And he stood up and he's gone like this. He stood up like that. And we're all next to him. And he put his hands around my girlfriend, who said that her granddad always looked like Muhammad Ali and had massive hands. And so he was a big hero of hers. And he put his hand round her. And then he sort of pinched her bum, sort of thing. and he goes, if I was 20 years younger. And I goes to him, if you weren't champion of the world.
He was always a bit of a sweet talker, wasn't he?
Yeah, he's a player. So then he's got to go on stage and, you know, he's got Parkinson's and they're helping him there. And Eric Schultz, the CEO of Adidas, is going, and this year, because Nike were number one at this point and they were spending, let's say they were spending 400 and something million US dollars at the thing. And he's like, and this year we're going to be number one. Impossible is nothing. We're going to spend $460 million. That made Adidas number one. Impossible is nothing. And the man that's going to lead us to that is Muhammad Ali, right? And no one knows he's there. And then he comes on the stage like shuffle. But where's he been shuffling up to the side? Then when he got onto by the side of the stage, he walked on and he walked like Muhammad Ali.
Yeah.
He walked onto stage and he looked at every audience member in the eye and properly focused on the noise, right? It was, there's about 400 delegates. They are going ballistic. And then he just does, stands there, does a magic trick because he can't speak, does the magic trick, goes off stage and collapses. But on stage, the crowd are going mad. And then the CEO comes on, right, we're going today. We're going to sell. And we're going to take over as number one in the world in sports brands. And yeah, that's what I'm saying about that. That mentality, the winner's mentality. Muhammad Ali, never give up. Never, ever, ever, ever give up. When I read his book about training and I read it as a kid, it's like he'd do press-ups till he can't do any more press-ups. Yeah? He's like fatigued. Then he'd ask his coach to count 100 press-ups. So he doesn't start counting till he's got nothing left. He'd run until he can't do another step. Then he'd go, right, I'm going to do 10 miles. Yeah, because that would be the thing when he's in the ring and you've got nothing left, like George Foreman against the Rumble in the Jungle and Thriller in the Manila with Fraser, when he's taking such punishment that's not human. It's that mindset. Yeah. I've trained for this every day. And I read about that. You know, I read autobiographies when I was young of my heroes and I just took everything on board.
That is powerful, yeah. I wanted to ask you how you've been like, what values you've been able to take from these people that you've met. And so it's, I love how you've touched on that. How have you been able to apply that to your life, that exact teaching that you just talked about?
Just in setting goals, you know, that's what I teach people in my coaching, setting goals, really strong goals, big goals, like my, you said there about my Steve Jobs and my goals where I want to improve the health and happiness and lifestyle. I used to say 10 million people. And then I did a podcast and someone said, I don't think 10 million is challenging enough for you. I went, well, that means I've got to hit the Chinese market and the Indian market. So my brain immediately, if you tell me something, then I'm going to work out how I'm going to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're in the UK. So, you know, like Joe Wicks, he hit 10 million people in lockdown, right? In lockdown, I did... yoga at 7 o'clock. He did one fitness session a day. I did yoga at 7 o'clock, midday meditation, and a 5 o'clock fitness. So for every one Joe Wicks did, I did three every day for 40 weeks. But I only got 20,000 followers. Joe Wicks got 10 million. No disrespect to Joe Wicks, because I love what he's done and his enthusiasm and all that sort of thing. But actual personal training or training and all that. I think if you find any personal trainer anywhere or knows about fitness, they would not say that he's a world-class trainer. But his enthusiasm and the thing that he's touched 10 million people and gone all around the world, and he's got 10 million people off their couches and doing things, that I've got enough respect for him. I've got, and his marketing when he's doing, you know, bish bash, put it in the pan, there we got it, lean in 15. That's genius. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? He was doing that from 2013, 2014. But if Joe Wicks can hit 10 million people, then I should be setting a target of a billion.
Yeah, it makes sense.
And that's why I get up, you know, I'm on Clubhouse at 5:30 in the morning doing my motivation, mindset and mindfulness. Yeah, today was the 25th consecutive day that you came in. Yeah, I just think setting goals, really big goals, and that you work every day, that's what gets you up out of bed, even when you do, like yesterday, it's Saturday, and I'm like knackered going, what the F am I getting up to do a thing on Clubhouse that I'm not getting paid for at 6:30 in the morning? you know, there was, I was tired. But then I was going through my goals because I'm writing a book, and I was updating that I've finished a book called Reset Your Life and Fit, and another one called Fit and Fabulous at 50. And so I was just updating them. So I was looking at my goal, and someone asked me, yeah, why are you getting up at 5:30? And then I looked at the thing and it said, because I'm going to improve the health, happiness and lifestyle of 1 billion people, which means I need to get up every day, because every day I'm going to touch one more person that's going to tell someone else, oh, you need to come in this room. And then, you know, Malcolm Gladwell, the tipping point, when you took one thing and then another and then another and then another, yeah. And then suddenly it reaches this thing, and that's when the floodgates open.
Hey, so I've decided to end part one there, where Kojo finished on some strong messages around how and why he manages to keep his motivation levels so high and the role that his upbringing played in this. And now that the scene has been set, part two is where we really start to dive into those pivotal moments that completely flipped Kojo's life. He also gives some fresh perspectives on how he views the role of coaches and role models. So you can know as soon as that episode is out by subscribing either on your podcast platform or at podcast.thejourneyonwards.com/tribe. Some of the stories will certainly keep you entertained. Until then, do not forget, have a great week.